My featured musical this evening is a 20th anniversary tribute to The Scarlet Pimpernel. Based on the famous novel by Baroness Orczy, it had book and lyrics by Nan Knighton and music by Frank Wildhorn. It opened at the Minskoff Theatre on the 9th of November back in 1997, where it had an initial run of 643 performances. But that's not the end of the story, as we shall learn a little later. And on tonight's programme, I shall feature the original 1997 Broadway cast recording. But waiting online in New York, it's my very great pleasure to welcome to the program via Skype the multi-Grammy and Tony Award-nominated theatre composer Frank Wildhorn. Welcome to Australia, Frank.
Rob, it is my pleasure. I love Australia.
Good to hear indeed. Well, I suppose looking into your musical background, do you come from a musical family or were you a one-off?
I guess I'm a one-off. I'm a self-taught piano player, kind of a jazz background, a lot of R&B and jazz. I stumbled into theater in the late 80s, early 90s. And, you know, it's funny. I just think of myself as a musician, as a composer. When I'm producing records, you know, that's the hat I'm wearing. Mm-hmm. And when I'm writing for theater, that's the hat I'm wearing. And, you know, I think the joy is the variety of the different hats I get to put on.
Indeed, yes. And I note that you were born in Harlem, New York, and that's a city with great musical associations, both for its African-American heritage, as well as your good self, too.
Yes, of course. And, you know, one of the things I'm very proud of, I was a producer of the first open-ended piece of theater at the Apollo Theater, Harlem Song that George Wolfe directed in the 90s and stuff. And, you know, that's my background and my roots and my home. Though it's funny because I actually grew up in Hollywood, Florida. Mm-hmm. my teenage years, I grew up in Florida and on the beach, very similar climate to some of the climates you have down under.
Ah, great. And what was the influence to get into musical theatre? Did you have any composers or theatrical productions that you were particularly enamored with in your early years that you thought, that's what I want to do?
You know, I get asked that a lot. And the truth of the matter is, you know, when I discovered music or when music discovered me, it was when I was 14 or 15. And at that time I was in Florida, and Hollywood, Florida was not what you would call a theater mecca. So I didn't get a chance to see a lot in those early days. But you know what? I saw the film versions back to back of West Side Story, mm-hmm. and Jesus Christ Superstar. I literally saw them back to back. I remember I was 14 and I was sick and I was in bed and I watched them. And as a young composer, I thought, wow, between these two shows is almost every style of music I'm interested in writing for. Mm-hmm. Was pop and rock and classical and jazz and more traditional, you know, what you would call musical comedy theater, but so many musical vocabularies. And something about seeing those two scores back to back really inspired me and set me off, I think.
Indeed, yes. And your first project, which you began in the University of Southern California, was Jekyll and Hyde. And I can confess to a bit of a family interest here because, believe it or not, Robert Louis Stevenson's a distant relative of mine. He was my maternal great-grandmother's second cousin.
Are you kidding me? Wow.
No, she was.
That's fantastic.
Well, she was a Stevenson.
And more than that, I mean, you were actually in Jekyll and Hyde from what I just learned.
Indeed, yes. But they never met. He did visit Australia, but only got as far as Sydney before he settled in Samoa in later life.
Right. He was always ill, wasn't he?
That's correct, yes. TB, I think it was. So he settled in a warmer climate to get away from the cold Scottish winters in Edinburgh.
You know that he wrote Jekyll and Hyde twice.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I believe that his wife destroyed the first manuscript, or he was unhappy with it and destroyed the first manuscript.
No, his wife. It was his wife. Yeah. She said, it's too scary. This will scare everybody. No one's going to read this. And she literally took it and threw it in the fire. And so he kind of took another shot at it. And, you know, it's so interesting because I wonder what that first one was, you know?
Still, I suppose it honed his skills at it, and it might have been not quite the success that it was if he'd gone with the first draft, perhaps.
Well, it's interesting. You know, the truth be told, the great English actor and I mean, just an amazing man named John Houseman. You might know.
Oh, certainly is.
He was. Yeah, so John Houseman was the artistic director at USC when I was there in the late 70s. And for some strange reason, he took a liking to me. Mm-hmm. And he took me to Frank Langella playing Dracula that was on tour in 1979 in Los Angeles.
Yes.
And it was that great Ed Gorey production. Mm-hmm. And I came away from it wanting to go back to school that semester and find my own Victorian horror thing and see if I can, you know, this is way before there was a Phantom, don't forget.
Yes.
And if I can do something with it. And, you know, the book of Jekyll and Hyde is a very thin little book. It's way ahead of its time and what it's about and the ideas behind it and stuff. But it's just a little book. But I felt compelled by the story, and I felt as a musician, I felt inspired by the fact that here's a challenge to give a musical identity to two different characters played by the same guy. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was a really, you know, cool thing to do back in 1979, 80. And that's really how Jekyll got started.
Ah, right. And then you came in contact with Leslie Bricus, who mentored you through the development process of what was, I guess, the third version of Jekyll and Hyde to that point.
Well, you know, Rob, it is many, many years later from when Leslie Bricus and I met in 1988, and he's still mentoring me. Because he's such an amazing guy. I know you've had the privilege to speak to him a few times at least. Mm-hmm. He teaches me more about life and how to live it than anything else. He's one of the great ones, and with one of the most amazing, and I'm going to say underrated, catalogs of songs that people don't realize what he's written. So I'm not only, you know, his partner, I'm a huge fan and advocate and always waving the Bricusian flag.
Indeed, yes. And it's amazing that at the age of 86, he shows no sign of slowing down. He's still got many projects on in various stages of preparation and many pots on the boil, so to speak.
I was with him on his... I'm very lucky. I get to see him, you know, quite a bit, as you can imagine. Mm-hmm. We have Jekyll and Hyde, and we also have our musical of Cyrano that's currently playing in Seoul. Actually, just closed last week. And that, and we have those two scores, but those two scores have, you know, taken on wonderful lives. So we're together all the time. But one thing I will tell you is I'll never forget this. We were in one of his homes in Acapulco, and he was 75 years old and celebrating his birthday, and he blew out the candles, and then he turned around and said to everybody, "So what am I going to do for the next half of my life?" I'll never forget that, and I try to take that a little of that with me every day, because no one lives like that guy. Let me tell you, Rob, nobody.
Indeed. And he said if ever he decided to retire, well, he wouldn't know what to do with himself. And I guess
he needed to know that word.
I guess that's the great advantage of being both a composer and, well, in his case, a lyricist as well, that inspiration, as long as the inspiration keeps coming, you never really need to retire.
Well, and also, you know, Leslie is somebody who, you know, the way he lives his life, he is so hip and he's so on top of what's going on culturally around the world at all times. So he's still a young man, you know, and this system. And, you know, it's amazing. I mean, it's that catalog of his. Mm-hmm. I mean, in 1963, he wrote Feeling Good, right?
Yes.
And last year, between Virgin Airlines and Weight Watchers, it probably made, you know, $3 or $4 million more. I mean, you know, he and people don't realize how amazing and how timeless his catalog is.
Mm-hmm. Indeed, yes. Well, he's got his, it was initially going to be Brick by Brick by Bricus, as one of his friends and whimsically called it, but pure imagination, the songs of Leslie Bricus. But
Yes. I'm proud to be part of that.
Well, I suppose we better get around to the Scarlet Pimpernel, and this was the second, well, first of all, of course, you added some additional music to the Broadway production of Victor Victoria, which principally, of course, had the score by Henry Mancini, who unfortunately had passed on by the date that it premiered on Broadway.
So here's the story of that you'll want to know. Mm-hmm. I have a horse farm upstate New York, and there's a music room on the farm, and I was writing in 1995, or I think it was. And of course, Leslie introduced me to Mr. Mancini many times. in the 90s, and we actually became friends, and he's a wonderful guy, and I think a fan of my work. And what happened was the phone rang, and I was writing one day, and there was a beautiful English voice on the other end, and saying that it was Julie Andrews, and that she had just heard the Jekyll and Hyde concept recording and an album I had just done with Linda Etter, and she was inviting me to finish the score of Victor Victoria with Henry's blessings. Of course, you know, he was ill and wasn't going to make it, etc. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was a good friend of mine imitating Julie Andrews, so I hung up on her.
Oh, dear.
And about 10 minutes later, the phone rang again, and she said, "Listen, it is Julie Andrews. Don't hang up on me." And she told me what she wanted to tell me, and that was the beginning of that adventure. So that's pretty crazy, right?
Indeed, yes.
Yeah. I suppose. And that was my first, you know, foray into theater.
Indeed, yes. I suppose history was repeating itself in one respect. I've spoken to Leslie about his childhood background, and he said that he used to go along to see all the MGM musicals, never realizing that he'd meet all these people in real life in later years.
Well, that's true. First of all, it's true. Second of all, you know, it's amazing. It's amazing. One of the things, you know, whether it was Sammy Davis doing This Is the Moment or Liza doing A New Life or certainly writing Living in the Shadows for Julie Andrews. I mean, I never, you know, growing up the way I grew up as a kind of struggling jazz R&B guy, mm-hmm. that wasn't in my sphere of dreams. So you could imagine that was pretty cool for me. I still wake up in the morning and can't believe what's going on. So,
indeed. Well, Jekyll and Hyde reached Broadway in April of 1997, of course, after the initial concept recordings had been around for a few years. And then the Scarlet Pimpernel followed in November. What was the genesis of the Scarlet Pimpernel and your meeting with Nan Knighton?
Okay, so Jimmy Niederlander, who passed away last year, one of the great icons of American theater, and of course the Niederlander family owns about half of the Broadway theaters. Mm-hmm. He, in his own way, discovered me also in 1987-88, and he actually brought me to New York. And he actually put up the first funds for the Jekyll and Hyde recordings, mm-hmm. and he housed my production company in New York, and I still owe him such a deep debt for getting me started in New York. Mm-hmm. He was the one originally that brought the Scarlet Pimpernel to me. And I had not seen the movie. I had not read the novel at the time. And I kept calling it the Scarlet Pumpernickel, which is the
Daffy Duck, yes.
And I didn't really know much about it. And I started reading the books, and okay, but they're not the easiest books in the style they're written to get through. And then I saw the miniseries with, Anthony Andrews and Jane Seymour.
Yes.
And then the original film with Leslie Howard and gorgeous Merle Oberon.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I saw that the Scarlet Pimpernel had what, you know, is kind of a formula for a lot of the musicals that I have around the world today, which is bigger than life characters and very high stakes, bigger than life circumstances. Mm-hmm. That's where opera comes from. That's where the music for me comes from. And so I kind of dug in, and I was thinking about different people who I would want to write the show with. And he's retired now, but there's a very famous and powerful lawyer from the theater world named John Braulio in New York. Mm-hmm. And I knew him because Jimmy Niederlander was one of his clients. And John got in touch with me and gave me some lyrics of a woman that he was representing named Nan Knighton.
Yes.
And I read these lyrics that were done before I'd given, of course, there was no music. So she was just kind of, you know, imagining songs in her head and writing lyrics. And I remember there was one where she rhymed Mal Cherie with haberdashery. And I thought this person is very clever and has a wonderful wit and gift. And I need to meet her. Mm-hmm. About that time, Jimmy had sent me to London to meet with Tim Rice about possibly working on the Scarlet Pimpernel.
Okay.
But when I got to London, you can't make this stuff up. Tim took me to his farmhouse. And at that time, Tim was with Elaine Page. Mm-hmm. And we got to the farmhouse and he opened the door. And as he opened the door, there was no furniture in the house. While he had been out of town, I guess Miss Page took the furniture. And so we sat on the floor and had a great conversation. But I think his mind was somewhere else that day, as it should have been.
Indeed, yes.
Anyway, nothing really came of that except the fact that I got to tell him how much I loved his work and what a genius he is. Mm-hmm. And on the way home, I opened the letter from John Braulio with these great lyrics. And when I came back, I left them for Jimmy Niederlander to see. I didn't have a chance to talk to him. Then Jimmy called me in his office and said, "Frank," because that's the way he talks. He said, "These are some of Tim's best work." And I said, "Actually, they're not Tim's work. They're this woman named Nan Knighton, who I don't know." And he said, "Nan Knighton, that's John Braulio's wife."
Ah.
So John Braulio, obviously being a brilliant guy like he is, he didn't want to tell me mm-hmm. that Nan Knighton was his wife.
Oh, I see.
Because he didn't want me to have any feelings of anything except just judging the lyrics. And to make a long story, I'm sorry, I'm pontificating.
Oh, that's
here,
quite all right.
But to make it shorter, I got to meet her and I loved her. And she is a wonderful, wonderful writer. I wish she would write more, but she doesn't. And she wrote the lyrics to The Scarlet Pimpernel. At that time, you know, I'm from the record world. You know, I ran a division of Atlantic Records for many years.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
Because of my success with Whitney Houston and Natalie Cole and Hootie and the Blowfish, blah, 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 I got a chance to do these precast and concept recordings. So believe it or not, I actually talked EMI Angel Records into doing a recording of these songs that Nan and I had written. Now, please understand, at that time, there was no book to the show, and it really wasn't a show.
Yes.
But everybody seemed to love these songs. And again, Linda Eder and the great R&B singer, Peebo Bryson, had a top 10 adult contemporary hit with You Are My Home.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that led to a lot of recognition of the show. In the meantime, a bunch of great, great writers took a shot at writing the book to the Scarlet Pimpernel show, including Mark Bramble, who wrote Barnum, Richard Nelson, who wrote Chess, Arthur Kopitz, who wrote Nine and Maury Esten's Phantom,
mm-hmm.
among others. There were more.
Oh.
But for some reason, Jimmy Niederlander wasn't really happy with any of them.
Yep.
And while all of this was going on, Nan was frustrated. So she took it upon herself, without telling anybody, she just wrote a book based on all the songs that we had written.
Ah, uh-huh.
And then, unfortunately, two things happened. Jimmy had a stroke. Mm-hmm. Jimmy Niederlander had a stroke. And so he was kind of out of commission for a while. But his associate at the Niederlanders, a wonderful woman who also had passed now, her name is Kathy Raitt. She brought together some amazing producers, including Bill Haber, who owned CAA, and the legendary Pierre Cossette, who invented the Grammy Awards,
yes.
and who produced them until he died. At a dinner, at one of those kind of New York dinner parties, she invited them all, and Ted Forstman, who used to own Gulfstream Jets, and played the album for everybody. And by the end of dinner, we had all these producers wanting to do the show, and Nan had a book, so we all met up, and there you go.
Oh, great.
That's how The Scarlet Pimpernel was born. And by the way, Rob, tonight, right as we're talking, The Scarlet Pimpernel is in rehearsal in Tokyo right now.
Oh, great.
Scarlet Pimpernel has been a huge, huge success in Tokyo in two separate ways, in two companies. There's the company called Takarazuka, which is all women,
mm-hmm.
very famous international company in Japan. They've now done it 3 or 4 times. And then Umeda Arts has done it last year for the first time with men and women. And it was such a success that they're in rehearsal to reopen in a few weeks right now.
Oh.
So the Scarlet Pimpernel is alive and well. And I hope this next year we'll find our way to London with it.
Oh, great. And you mentioned there that the lyrics came first. Is that generally how you work, or do you vary the method of composition with the different collaborators that you work with as to whether lyrics come first or the music comes first?
No, actually, the music comes first, Rob. Okay. And the lyrics that she wrote on spec before there was a book, and of course, before I had written any music.
Yeah.
The lyrics that she wrote on spec got her the job. Once she got the job, then we would have a series of conversations and picked out what we thought were obvious places for songs to go. And then I always go first. I write the music first. In the pop world, I've written most of the lyrics to my records over the years. So I have a pretty good feel for, you know, what I want to go for, what I want to say. And the music usually comes first. That's how it works with Leslie as well. And then they go from there.
Mm-hmm, indeed. Yeah, I've had the pleasure of interviewing Sheldon Harnick on a number of occasions, and he said that the way that he and Jerry Bock used to work is that, first of all, Jerry would study the music of a particular country or era in which their shows were set, and then compose in an idiom and put down all these musical themes on tape, on a tape recording, which he'd then give to Sheldon, and Sheldon would go through and listen to the music and see if any of them inspired particular lyrics or for particular spots in the show. Is that something similar to the method that you adopt?
Yeah, it is. I've been very lucky with Leslie and with guys like Don Black and Christopher Hampton and Nan, of course. You know, we usually have a series of meetings and you know, maybe the odd treatment, you know, just sketching out some of the main points of where we want to go. And then I'm a visceral guy, so I write from my heart, and it's kind of almost like Zen.
Mm-hmm.
I always describe it like fishing. The fish are there and I have to go find it, you know. And some days you catch a big one and some days you don't catch anything. But I'll go first and based on that. And usually that's the way it starts. You know, that's that first, you know, creative impulse.
Mm-hmm, indeed. And then once the production is launched, well, these days, of course, they have previews, whereas in the old days they used to take the shows on pre-Broadway tours, but that's apparently uneconomical these days. So,
well, you know, it depends who you got producing, you mm-hmm. know, Rob. If it's Disney, you know, it's all part of their research and development budget, I guess. You know, if it's normal people, they still try to go somewhere before. I mean, Bonnie and Clyde went to La Jolla, California, and then Sarasota, Florida before Broadway. Pimpernel didn't, though. Pimpernel was very lucky. We did a bunch of workshops in New York, and because of Kathy Raid and Bill Haber and these guys, they just raised all the money, you know, in kind of one big slew there. And then, of course, Doug Sills came into our world. And once he came into the world, I kind of rewrote a lot of it just based on him and his unbelievable talents.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I guess you have to sort of tailor the music to the vocal range of the particular performers that you're writing for.
Well, you know, everybody has their own way of doing things. The history of my career, the biggest successes I've had is when I've known the voices I was writing for. So, you know, when I'm doing a show, I have voices in my mind that I'm hearing. Mm-hmm. But if somebody walks in the room like a Doug, you then tailor it to him, you know, and then you go from there. And in this case, that's what happened.
Uh-huh. And do you write any new songs during preview periods, thinking, that moment isn't working properly, perhaps that needs a new song or a different song?
The answer is not only yes, I'm still writing songs to these shows. last year, Scarlet Pimpernel in Japan, the guy who was the star is a big star.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, big star comes to you and says, listen, you know, I respect that you've done this for all these years and stuff, but I am who I am, and please write me a big hit song in Act Two.
Uh-huh.
Okay. I have no problem with that. I think it's great. I get to revisit the material and then yet look at it so fresh because it's been years. And again, if there's a big star attached to it that I know is going to help sell it, and it has he or she has a voice I want to write for, I love doing that. I'm not about doing cookie cutout versions of my shows. I like to keep them alive and vibrant.
Mm-hmm, indeed. And The Scarlet Pimpernel was quite unique in that the original Broadway production closed at the end of May in 1999 and then reopened in a revised production with new stars, other than Douglas Sills, in a different theatre for a further 129 performances.
Well, even before that, Rob, Scarlet Pimpernel, I mean, you can't make this stuff up. Scarlet Pimpernel opened, and let me think how to tell this story. So there was another set of producers that eventually came into the show. They loved the show, but they didn't think it was it was quite there. So they actually came to the original producers and me and Nan and said, listen, we're willing to put X more millions of dollars into the show, but we want this director and we want to recast a couple of parts and it'll be Scarlet Pimpernel 2.0. So what happened is somewhere, I think the end of the first year or beginning of the second year, we were playing one show at night and rehearsing a different one during the day. And then eventually we had to kind of change over and we did that, right?
Yes.
So now we're in our second year. And in fact, the New York Times, you know, which has not always been the biggest fan, they actually liked Scarlet Pimpernel 2.0, got a good review from the Times, which, you know, hallelujah. My mom was happy about that. So, because why are they always beating you up, Frank? You know? So 2.0 was running, and unbeknownst to all of us, this is, again, so crazy, Jimmy Niederlander had previously made a deal with Robert Stigwin, that when Saturday Night Fever was ready, that show would go into the Minskoff. And so in the middle of, I think it's like the second year, and now we're rolling. We're doing very, very well, and we're, you know, making money for everybody, et cetera, et cetera. Jimmy Niederlander calls us all to his office and says, I got bad news for you. Unfortunately, I had made a deal before we opened that when Robert was ready, we were going to move on Saturday Night Fever. So we got kicked out of the theater. Can you believe that?
Indeed. Yes.
Okay. Uh-huh. It's like having a restaurant and it takes you 2 years to build a following in the restaurant and you finally made it and someone says, now you got to move. I mean, that's tough, right? That's tough.
Indeed.
Okay. So we went to the Neil Simon, but we couldn't get into the Neil Simon for about 6 months. So we then went on tour for a while. We played LA and some big cities, did very well. But of course, it was then, you know, it was like the next season already. And then we opened at the Neil Simon, and we always called that 3.0. So it had three lives on Broadway. And I'm sure they'll do a revival one day because it's got quite a big fan following and stuff. But Rob, again, you can't make that up. That's how crazy it is. So we opened the show. A year later, we reopened the show at the same theater, but with more producers and a different director. And then at the end of that next year, we're told we can't stay in the theater. So then we go on tour and come back to Broadway at another theater. How crazy is that? What business works like that?
Indeed. And I believe both with Jekyll and Hyde and Scarlet Pimpernel, you had a rather avid fan base who kept coming back to the show again and again.
Well, with Jekyll, of course, we have the Jackies. And the Jackies are international. I mean, you know, there's been over 1,600 productions of Jekyll and Hyde. And Jekyll and Hyde is the longest running show in the history of South Korea in Seoul. This March will be its 8th year, the reopening in Tokyo. And I don't know if Leslie has told you, you know, they are deep into developing the film in Hollywood right now with a great set of producers. So it's the gift that keeps giving. But it's interesting, in the last years, Scarlet Pimpernel has had a great revival in Europe and in Asia. And we have a producer right now in London that's trying to get it there. So, you know, look, it's a crazy business. And, you know, knock wood, you know, these things have taken on lives and they're very long, beautiful lives.
Indeed, yes. And would I be right in saying that you're quite unique in that you don't just concentrate on Broadway or indeed American musicals, but you've also branched into both Europe and Asia, having original commissions for shows to be performed in those countries?
Yeah, I have a very strange career, Rob. We have, I think, 22 shows around the world right now. And I swear to you, as I'm sitting in front of my piano, there are 10 commissions on my piano as we speak. They're from Rush, from St. Petersburg, and from Seoul, and from Tokyo, and from Budapest, and from Prague, from Broadway, from London. It's a crazy time. I try not to think about it too much. I just have too much fun doing it. And, you know, because I started in the pop business, because I worked for a publisher when I started, that basically said, listen, if stars don't do your songs, your kids are not going to eat. So you better have songs that people will record. Mm-hmm. And I was always taught back then from my publisher that you write for the world. And at the end of the day, maybe 60 to 70% of your income and your kids' income will come from international. So I'm not one of those guys who grew up with, you know, five blocks in New York City is the center of the universe. Mm-hmm. New York is the center of New York. I always say, and my friend Stephen Schwartz always reminds me, but I've always written for the world. I love the kind of international experience of working in other cultures and just other, you know, artists from around the world and exploring their viewpoints, because music, like love, Rob, knows no borders. So if you, you know, that's a philosophy of mine and a philosophy of my life. And it's been a wonderful ride. We are currently on right now.
Indeed. And speaking of philosophy, I note that you studied history and philosophy at university. And I guess that history has informed the choice of material that you go in for the various musicals that you write. Not only Victorian Gothic horror, as in Jekyll and Hyde and Dracula, but also The Count of Monte Cristo and Cyrano de Bergerac, of course, and even the American Civil War.
Yeah, I have two sons. And I know people always assume, because I was a history major and passionate about that, which I am, mm-hmm. that so much of my material will come from, you know, history or you know, Victorian literature or things like that. I am attracted to great timeless stories and then telling those stories in a musical vocabulary that young people will understand. Mm-hmm. You know, as Camelot was to my parents, Excalibur I wrote for my kids, because, you know, with all the love for Lerner and Lowe, my teenage kids were not going to sit for Camelot. That's mm-hmm. not what their ears are attuned to. Mm-hmm. So, you know, shows like that and Monte Cristo and Cyrano and The Man Who Laughs, and those are great titles written by great writers. So the source material is so strong. And I just love the idea of taking those things, but like I said, you know, looking at them through a prism and hearing them through a prism of a modern musical vocabulary and introducing young people to that. With that said, you know, the Civil War was written because my kids were studying the Civil War in school, and I didn't think they were into it as much as they should be. So I love Civil War. I'm kind of a Civil War geek. Mm-hmm. And my son was in middle school, and he was reading a Frederick Douglass speech. And he wasn't getting it. And I said, you don't understand. This is cool and you should know it. I said, well, if Hootie and the Blowfish was singing these words, would you listen then? And he made the mistake. And he made the mistake of saying, yeah, Dad, you go make that happen. And hence, that was the beginning of Civil War.
Great. Well, other than the projected film version of Jekyll and Hyde, have you been approached to compose for the cinema as such?
I have, and I also had a development deal with Warner Brother Pictures under the auspices of Lauren Shula Donna and Dick Donna. Lauren, of course, produces all the X-Men films, and Dick Donna was the director of all the Lethal Weapons and The Omen and Scrooged and Superman, the Christopher Reeve Superman. So they were champions of mine and stuff. But in hanging out, especially with some of the great film composers, and being such a songwriter, they always said to me, Frank, it's better to wake up in the morning and really kind of be responsible for your own work. Some great film composers even said some of the best work we did, if the movie's not successful, nobody really hears. Mm-hmm. And that was a turning point for me. And I think I just went that songwriter way, which included, you know, my pop career. And then, of course, going into theater where, you know, and as you know, the composer is an author. Yes. In theater. So you do have control and ownership of your work. I've dabbled in film a little bit. I'm sure I'm about to do a little bit more of that in the next couple of years. But I'm really a songwriter, like Leslie is. Really a songwriter first.
Ah, great. Well, we wish you every success with your future projects. And by the sounds of things, you'll have enough on your plate to keep you busy until you're in your 80s at least.
Well, I hope we'll be able to talk as the years go on and check in with each other, because since you've been in Jekyll and Pimpernel, I can't wait to see which of my shows you're going to be in next.
Oh, right. Well, time is moving on, so I'd like to thank my special guest, Frank Wildhorn, for coming on tonight's show to talk about the background to The Scarlet Pimpernel and also a little about the rest of his career. Thank you very much for your time, Frank, and hopefully we won't have to wait too much longer for some professional productions of your musicals in Australia, including Jekyll and Hyde and Cyrano de Bergerac. I look forward to speaking with you again in the future.
It's been a lot of fun and a great pleasure. Thank you so much, Rob.
Great. Bye for now.
Okay, bye-bye.